White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager. Well, I guess it's not really evening everywhere, but getting close to it. And the introduction music you just heard is from Breaking Up Christmas, done by master fiddler Bruce Molsky with Mike Seeger on the banjo. We selected this music for this program because Henry Ford was a big fan of 19th century fiddle music and folk dancing. He even played the fiddle himself, and he encouraged its popularity. My co-host on the International Jew Study Hour is also a fiddler, Hadding Scott. Isn't that right, Hadding?
Yes, that's correct.
I know you don't want to talk about your fiddling, but I think there's what's great.
Well, I took up fiddling after I read Cold Mountain, because there's an old guy in the novel that takes up fiddling, and it kind of changes your life. You don't need a TV anymore if you can fiddle.
Really, it's that much fun, huh?
Well, you got your own entertainment. You are the entertainment.
And didn't you tell me that fiddling, for you anyway, was easier than playing the banjo?
Banjo is very idiosyncratic. Yeah, it was easier.
Yeah, I would just think it was the opposite, as I said. But anyway, I think that's great. And, you know, Henry Ford was an American, a great American, and there's nothing more American than this kind of music. And there's just, you know, you can't get farther away from Jewish music than this, I don't think. So this program, ladies and gentlemen, is going to consist of studying Henry Ford's great published work, The International Jew. We're going to start with some background on how it came about and try to separate fact from fiction, or at least misconceptions that have spread around. The first thing to know is that Henry Ford did not sit down and write this himself. He had it written by a team of researchers and writers. And so I'm going to go ahead, because Hadding wants to let me do this part. So what?
Go ahead.
Oh, anytime you have something to say, I'll ask you, okay? Or sometimes I'll ask you, but if you want to break in, go ahead. Now, it's important to know the context of how this book came about, and it's kind of complicated. I didn't do a whole lot of research, but I'd researched it earlier, and there's not a lot of places where you can read about it. So the best that I can come up with is that there was something called the Ford International Weekly, which was established in 1901, or the Ford International Weekly was published by Henry Ford from 1919 through 1927. That's not right either, is it? Because there was a weekly newspaper established in 1901, and I can't tell whether it was called the Ford International Weekly. If it was called Ford, that mean Henry Ford, I guess, but he supposedly didn't start publishing his paper until 1919. Anyway, the first issue under Ford's direction appeared on January 11, 1919, and the subtitle of the publication was Chronicler of the Neglected Truth. Very fast, interesting title, isn't it? And it created a sensation when it published the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and later it ran the headline on the cover, The International Jew, the World's Problem. This was on May 22nd, 1920, so a year
world's
and a half.
World's foremost problem, isn't it?
Well, the first one was just The International Jew, the World's Problem, and this is the issue that we're using as a graphic image that you can see on the program pages, and it will continue to be there. Maybe we should change to a different image once in a while. This is going to run for a long time. But anyway, it seems to be the most iconic image for it, And we'll get to the foremost problem in a minute. So the initial staff of the newspaper included E.G. Pip, who was previously managing editor of the Detroit News, So, you know, Ford was getting top-notch people to do this project. He also had writers William J. Cameron, who was also formerly of the Detroit News, and Marcus Woodruff, and then Fred Black was his business manager. And as I already said, he did not write, but he rather expressed his opinions verbally to his executive secretary, Ernest Liebold, and to the paper's editor, William Cameron, already mentioned. Now, Cameron replaced Pip as editor in April 1920, when Pip disagreed with the plan to publish anti-Jewish articles beginning in May. So this was the guy who didn't want to be any part of that. And so Cameron then had the responsibility for writing the articles and expanding Ford's view within them. But it says that Liebold was actually the main brain behind it. He had hired this group of detectives and investigators, and they were so he was responsible for collecting the material to support the article. So Liebold was working right under Ford, and he had hired these investigators and so on, and then the material was given to Cameron, and Cameron wrote the articles, and Ford's name was put on them. So Ford didn't mind having his name, because he was the one who, with the big reputation, and the one that people would really pay attention to. So that's how they did it. I think the highest circulation his paper ever had was 900,000 by 1925. But the thing is, he circulated this paper through his automobile dealerships. Yeah. And every Ford dealer was sent a number of these papers, and they had to pass them out to customers and so on. And that's how the paper got so widely read. Now, this Ernest Liebold, Ernest, who was Ford's trusted private secretary, he helped to organize this special detective agency, I said. And it was generously financed by Ford. Ford sunk a lot of money into this, and he investigated prominent Jews and Gentile liberals who were thought to be crypto-Jews, they say. The detective agency, now this is, you know, coming from Metapedia, but that's better than Wikipedia, so, but you know, they have their own way of saying things. This is not, you know, I'm not vouching for everything I'm saying here. This is the best I can come up with. What, Hattie?
I don't think they're quite as careful on Metapedia. I mean, there's
not
a lot
as
of
careful
bias
as Wikipedia.
There are a lot of bias on Wikipedia, but they're also more rigorous.
Okay, I had Wikipedia here too, and I just decided to use the Metapedia part because there's too much.
Everything you said sounds reasonable.
Yeah,
so far.
Yeah. It's about the same, except there's a little bit more of this stuff on Metapedia. So the detective agency was headquartered in New York under the direction of C.C. Daniels, who was a former lawyer for the Justice Department. Now, you know, these are not just your usual sloppy guys. I mean, these are professionals here doing this. And many of those employed were former Secret Service agents, they say, and white Russian exiles such as Boris Brazol, B-R-A-S-O-L. Then William Cameron, again, was the editor, and it was called the Independent, the Dearborn Independent by then, and he wrote most of the paper's articles. Well, I already said that. See, this is a repetition here. However, it says that Cameron realized and admitted that it was Liebold, through his efficiencies, who ran the paper. Even though Cameron was the editor and so on, Liebold kind of behind the scene running the detective agency and so on, and being closer to Ford, he was the person most responsible for it. So, and I, you know, my comment here, Hattie, is that that's what it takes to get something done. Look at Ford had he had the money, he had the prestige, he was a very successful businessman. He had everything going for him. And if you didn't have all that, you couldn't have undertaken such a project as this, right?
Yeah, it reminded me of Ross Perot, how he could have gotten elected president through his own efforts and his own wealth.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, good point.
He had the money.
Yeah, money. So, all right, a little bit more here. The newspaper published the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, I had said. And during this period, Ford emerged as a respected spokesman for right-wing extremism and religious prejudice. And this is what, you know, the way that, I think this is from Wikipedia.
Right,
and,
there's no religious prejudice in this that I noticed, but...
Well, no, because, but he's a Christian, and so that's how they portray it. Well, you know, he's prejudiced against Jews.
The tone of it is, I think you can dispute the accuracy of a lot of the particular claims in the International Jew, but the overall tone of it is not... religiously biased at all, and it's not even racially biased against the Jews. It really has a very fair tone to it, even though I think some of the facts are mistaken.
Well, I don't. Of course, to Jews, it doesn't have a fair tone, and this is what we're talking about. This is probably who wrote this. I mean, He was a white right wing extremist, although respected. And religious prejudice, because he was writing about the Jews are the major problem in the world. That's pretty, you know, that's not real. Yeah. That's a little bit strong, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's either true or it's not.
Well, there you go, but they don't
either.
Care
as for
about
being
that.
A right-wing extremist, I think trying to keep America the way it was, how could that be extremism? That's the definition of conservatism.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, I'm reading this as though I'm saying it, but this is actually from what Wikipedia says, so let's keep that in mind. Okay, and then there's also this little item that Ford is the only American mentioned in Mein Kampf. Hitler wrote, only a single great man, Ford, who to the Jews, he probably said to them, to their fury, still maintains full independence from the controlling masters of the producers in a nation of 120 million. So there, he was even mentioned in Mein Kampf. So that would certainly make him turn him into a right-wing extremist, right? And he was friendly toward Hitler's regime. And all of that, we might go into that as we go along through the book, come up with opportunities to do that. So right now, we'll just say here that, now again, according to these articles, Ford's motivation. What do you think of this? Henry Ford was a pacifist who opposed World War I. That's true. And he believed that Jews were responsible for starting wars in order to profit from them. A quote from him, and you don't know, you know, how these quotes are taken out of context or whatever, but anyway, this is the quote. And it sounds like I'm sure he believed this. International financiers are behind all war. They are what is called the international Jew. German Jews, French Jews, English Jews, American Jews. I believe that in all those countries except our own, the Jewish financier is supreme. Here, the Jew is a threat. I found this real interesting because it shows us that Ford did believe that America had not yet been taken over altogether by Jewish power and that we still had a chance, and that's why he did this, because he thought he could save us. He thought he could head it off and teach Americans about the Jews, and they would know how to protect themselves. He went all out in this way, and spent a huge amount of money, millions of dollars, I guess, in order to save America from the Jews.
I think at the time he wrote that, he's probably correct. It was the beginning of broadcasting that really. Seems to have marked the solidification of Jewish power in the United States.
Okay, right.
Because it dominated the broadcasting industry. And that was a very powerful weapon for controlling people's thinking.
Yeah. And so he was on the right track. And I know I read in some of the later chapters that I was reading in the Southern newspaper that he kind of, he told people to keep up their courage because we were going to, you know, he was exposing this and that. He said, we were going to overcome this, so we would come out successful. We would come out ahead. So he believed in what he was doing. He probably, and he was very religious, and he probably thought you know, he was on God's side, and we would save ourselves from what happened to Europe. But anyway, the other news, let's see. Oh, yeah, the Dearborn Independent. I've got a page here of the Dearborn Independent from August 1921. And it says the Ford International Weekly, the Dearborn Independent, and it has a number of articles. It's old fashioned looking, you know. It's got the heading at the top, and then a big box, and then it's got articles with different size type in there showing what's inside the. So I was wondering, see if this newspaper of his was just about the Jews, just that one thing. But no, he had various articles, but they weren't really like. Newspapers have. They were kind of magazine-type articles, a lot of them. And then his main article would be what is now in the International Jew, the Jewish thing. And this one, the main article in the center says, Jewish jazz moron music becomes our national music. And it's a story of popular song control in the United States. So the others, right above that, in smaller type, it says, Fighting the Devil in Modern Babylon. This is a story about New York and I had it, but I can't read it now, written by a Reverend Dr. John somebody. But a series, it's a series of articles on New York. Of course, New York is the modern Babylon. And then he's got another one that's called The Chief Justices of the Supreme Court, and they're talking about that. And then the other four are kind of one is about science and medicine. Another one is about natural, you know, the Fountain Lake, the home of John Muir. He was a great naturalist, Henry Ford. And so this one is probably an article about nature and so on. And then one, teaching the deaf to hear with their eyes. So, you know, helping people. And many byproducts from sweet potatoes. I love things like that. See, now that's real wholesome. And he's just probably an article about all the things that can be made or done or from sweet potatoes, besides just eating them. Well, that's the kind of that's what was in the issue for August 1921. So he was already underway there.
That was a monthly newspaper.
No, weekly.
Oh, weekly.
Yeah. Yeah. So once a week. Well, I don't know how much he put in each time because the book, The International Jew, it's in four parts and it has 80 chapters. And if he did a chapter every week, that would have been just 80 weeks. So he must have not put that much in. I don't know at all. I don't have the answers to some of these things. Because I don't have the newspapers. But in any event, more about what he has said about Jews. He believed Jews in their role as financiers did not contribute anything of value to society. This comes from one of these Wikipedia or something. And he just saw them as a conspiratorial group that now he's talking about the financiers all the time. He's not talking about your everyday Jewish person, you know, living in the tenements in New York or something. He is. He specifies that he's talking about, what we would call today the world jewelry power and so on. And he says they operate in concert to gain. Well, these are my words: to gain money and power in key areas and industries, which they then took over. I mean, he was very clear about all that. That they were doing this, and it was extremely harmful to the rest of us. And he says in 1915 during World War One. He blamed Jews for instigating the war, saying, I know who caused the war, German Jewish bankers. That's supposed to be a quote. And then 10 years later in 1925, that was in 1925, he said, what I oppose most is the international Jewish money power that is met in every war. That is what I oppose, a power that has no country and that can order the young men of all countries out to death. So. Well, there's an opinion here by Kevin Strom, which I thought was really well written, but I don't know if I'm going to read it. But, you know, he says that Henry Ford didn't have to do what he did. He was a living incarnation of success. He was the richest industrialist of his day. He was loved and admired by millions. He among the common people, he was ranked with the greatest men of all time. You know, political power could have been his if he had wanted it. But he did go forward with this investigation and explication of the Jewish question at the cost of a large portion of his wealth, at the cost of much of the time and energy of an aging older man, and at the cost of the alienation of many friends, associates, and even family members. You know, he put his life in peril by opposing these powerful moneyed interests. And we know that they did manage to bring him down to some extent, and he had to stop what he was doing. Finally, he tried not to, but he finally had to because of what all that they were bringing up against him. So, but the point here being made here is that we all have a duty to transcend these fears and considerations, as Henry Ford did, and to think about the future that our children will have. Well, so now we are ready to actually start. It took a little longer than I thought, but reading The International Jew, Volume 1. And we're going to start with the preface. And Hanning, would you mind reading that?
The whole
sound preface. I feel like the teacher. Hanning, would you read the next portion, the preface?
Yes, Ms. Jaeger.
Okay.
Why discuss the Jewish question? Because it is here, and because its emergence into American thought should contribute to its solution, and not to a continuance of those bad conditions which surround the question in other countries. The Jewish question has existed in the United States for a long time. Jews themselves have known this, even if Gentiles have not. There have been periods in our own country when it has broken forth with a sullen sort of strength which presaged darker things to come. Many signs portend that it is approaching an acute stage. Not only does the Jewish question touch those matters that are of common knowledge, such as financial and commercial control, usurpation of political power, monopoly of necessities, and autocratic direction of the very news that the American people read, but it reaches into cultural regions and so touches the very heart of American life. This question reaches down into South America and threatens to become an important factor in Pan-American relations. It is interwoven with much of the menace of organized and calculated disorder which troubles the nations today. It is not of recent growth, but its roots go deep, and the long past of this problem is counterbalanced by prophetic hopes and programs which involve a very deliberate and creative view of the future. This little book is the partial record of an investigation of the Jewish question. It is printed to enable interested readers to inform themselves on the data published in the Dearborn Independent prior to October 1, 1920. The demand for back copies of the paper was so great that the supply was exhausted early, as was also a large edition of a booklet containing the first 9 articles of the series. The investigation still proceeds, and the articles will continue to appear as heretofore until the work is done. The motive of this work is simply a desire to make facts known to the people. Other motives have, of course, been ascribed to it, but the motive of prejudice or any form of antagonism is hardly strong enough to support such an investigation as this. Moreover, had an unworthy motive existed, some sign of it would inevitably appear in the work itself. We confidently call the reader to witness that the tone of these articles is all that it should be. The International Jew and his satellites, as the conscious enemies of all that Anglo-Saxons mean by civilization, are not spared. Nor is that unthinking mass which defends anything that a Jew does, simply because it has been taught to believe that whatever Jewish leaders do is Jewish. Neither do these articles proceed upon a false emotion of brotherhood and apology, as if this stream of doubtful tendency in the world were only accidentally Jewish. We give the facts as we find them. That of itself is sufficient protection against prejudice or passion. This volume does not complete the case by any means, but it brings the reader along one step. In future compilations of these and subsequent articles, the entire scope of the inquiry will more clearly appear. October 1920.
Okay, so we're in October 1920. You know, I think it's important to point out or clarify or whatever, repeat or whatever, that the 1920s were like in America and around the world. Of course, World War One had ended in 1918, and now we're already in a new age of prosperity, except for some people in Europe, like the Germans and some others. But in America, you know, things were starting to go, and then you had the boom of the 1920s, the time that much of this was being written. And also morals, you know, everything changed, right? I mean, you had I can't think now that I had it before in my mind, the girl, you know, the
flappers.
The flappers, right, thanks. And you know, all this liberation and women, girls, young women, and probably older women too, cut their hair short. They wore short skirts, short dresses. Hemlines, you know, went up, and they wore bright red lipstick, and they went out and about and had fun. They smoked, and they, you know, they just drank a lot. And not everybody did that, of course. I mean, the Fords were living very quietly. in their folk dancing lifestyle and so on, and nature lifestyle. But this was part of the tone of this time, that the Jews were rising in America. So, and then there was another thing here I wondered if it was worth commenting on, which is when he says here, nor is that unthinking mass which defends anything that a Jew does simply because it has been taught to believe that what Jewish leaders do is Jewish. Yeah. Do you have some insight on that?
I think he's talking about the mass of Jews, how they follow in lockstep whatever their leaders or their Jewish organizations say. You know, they take their cues from their leaders.
Oh, he's talking about the Jews. Okay.
I think so.
Okay, that makes more sense. I couldn't quite understand that. All right. Very good. Well, okay, I'll take a stab at reading.
I want to just disagree a little bit there.
Okay.
You said 1920. There were some economic problems right after World War One. There was a big farm credit crisis around 1920. And basically my impression is that the opulence of the 1920s was largely fueled by a giant credit bubble.
Okay, and when did it start? Because of course I know it wasn't really there in 1920.
I'm not an expert on this, but there were credit problems right after the war. There were I read about this a few months ago, where farmers were complaining that market prices had been manipulated, and they ended up losing their farms.
Nobody says that the farmers were enjoying that boom in the 20s. It wasn't really the farmers, probably, although they might have gotten in on it eventually too. But you know, it was the speculators and so on, and real estate people. Who else? I mean, but it was there was just a change in the. Eventually, there was a change in the moral atmosphere in the cities, certainly in New York, especially. And
Chicago.
A lot of this book is, yeah, Chicago, a lot of
yeah,
this
Prohibition
book is centered in New
is
York. I mean, the investigators go into a lot, because that's where the Jews were congregated mostly. So that's where you studied what they were up to. Okay, it's 7:29, so we're probably not doing too badly. I'll go ahead and read some paragraphs here. And see how that goes, and then I'll ask you again. And if you want to break in adding on anything, you go ahead, please. All right, the title of chapter one is the kind of a foundation for the whole Well, you know, he wrote part one, which has got quite a few chapters. I didn't look to see how many this time, but he wrote part one, and then they started doing more work, and he had part two, and then he did more, and you know, it ended up with four whole books. So this one is starts with the Jew in character and business. Interesting, because last Saturday I had Kairos on. We talked about the German character. Now we're going to talk about the Jewish character. Among the distinguishing mental and moral traits of the Jews may be mentioned distaste for hard or violent physical labor, a strong family sense, and philoprogenitiveness. That is, they want to, I guess, generate a lot of their own kind, right? Very strongly. Yeah. A marked religious instinct. The courage of the prophet and martyr rather than of the pioneer and soldier. Now, this actually is quoted from the New International Encyclopedia. So in those days, the encyclopedias would write like this about Jews. You couldn't possibly say these things, distaste for hard labor. Continuing on, they were not pioneers or soldiers. Remarkable power to survive in adverse environments, combined with great ability to retain racial solidarity. Capacity for exploitation, both individual and social. Shrewdness and astuteness in speculation and money matters generally. An oriental love of display and a full appreciation of the power and pleasure of social position. A very high average of intellectual ability. And again, as I said, that's from the New International Encyclopedia at the time that Ford, or these writers, took it from there. All right, the Jew is again being singled out for critical attention throughout the world. His emergence in the financial, political, and social spheres has been so complete and spectacular since the war that his place, power, and purpose in the world are being given a new scrutiny, much of it unfriendly. Persecution is not a new experience to the Jew, but intensive scrutiny of his nature and supranationality is. I bolded that. That's kind of interesting.
I can see the Jew screaming under the microscope right now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's what that's about. He has suffered for more than 2,000 years from what may be called the instinctive anti-Semitism of the other races. But this antagonism has never been intelligent, nor has it been able to make itself intelligible. Nowadays, however, the Jew is being placed, as it were, under the microscope of economic observation, that the reasons for his power, the reasons for his separateness, the reasons for his suffering may be defined and understood. In Russia, he is charged with being the source of Bolshevism, an accusation which is serious or not, according to the circle in which it is made. We in America, having the fervid eloquence and perceiving the prophetic ardor of young Jewish apostles of social and industrial reform, can calmly estimate how it may be.
Now, you see what he's saying there. He's saying we see how many Jews that have come to the United States are troublemakers. That's what he's saying there. And to some extent, he's inferring what the situation in Europe probably is based on what he's seen in the United States, what a lot of people have seen in the United States. They used to actually run articles in the New York Times at the turn of the 20th century that would mention the prominence of Jews in anarchism and so forth.
But well, right. That. Yeah, that's right. They were still aliens then, for the most part. And they hadn't reached the level that they have now. Now, but you had said to me earlier that you disagreed with him. Is this the part, or does it come up later about Bolshevism?
He hasn't gotten into that yet.
Okay, all right, I'll keep going then. In Germany, the Jew is charged with being the cause of the empire's collapse, and a very considerable literature has sprung up, bearing with it a mass of circumstantial evidence that gives the thinker pause. I like that. In England, he is charged with being the real-world ruler, who rules as a supernation over the nations, rules by the power of gold, and who plays nation against nation for his own purposes, remaining himself discreetly in the background. In America, it is pointed out to what extent the elder Jews of wealth and the younger Jews of ambition swarmed through the war organizations, principally those departments which dealt with the commercial and industrial business of war, and also the extent to which they have clung to the advantage which their experience as agents of the government gave them. There's more about this later on, I'm sure, about their how they behaved in the war organizations. And even Arthur Butts wrote about that in his Hoax of the 20th Century about of course, this is World War One, but about how the Jews were in charge of so many of the war organizations in World War Two, and then they get all they're good at it because a lot of this is like, they have to organize goods, they have to food for the soldiers, they have to move things around. You know, it's all very business.
They've got the network already.
They've got the network, right? And that's why they beat others out at doing that. And so they just had carte blanche almost. They were doing it all for us, you know, in our wars, running our wars like that. Yeah. In simple words, the question of the Jews has come to the fore. But like other questions which lend themselves to prejudice, efforts will be made to hush it up as impolitic for open discussion. If, however, experience has taught us anything, it is that questions thus suppressed will sooner or later break out in undesirable and unprofitable forms. The Jew is the world's enigma. Poor in his masses, he yet controls the world's finances. Scattered abroad without a country or government, yet he presents a unity of race continuity which no other people has achieved. Living under legal disabilities in almost every land that is certain legal restrictions, he has become the power behind many a throne. There are ancient prophecies to the effect that the Jew will return to his own land and from that center rule the world, though not until he has undergone an assault by the United Nations of mankind. Now, I think that's really fascinating. People write about those prophecies. I don't really know about them that much firsthand, but yeah, the idea, and the Jews are very superstitious or mystical about following these prophecies of theirs and so on, so that they feel like they are really, they have that to point to and say that they're doing the will of God or whatever. This is what's supposed to happen.
The Orthodox Jews are.
I bet Bibi Netanyahu likes to point out things like this. Now, they say that, you know, they would return to their own land and rule the world from there after they had undergone an assault by the United Nations of mankind. Now, I take that to be the Holocaust. They've turned what happened to them there into something called the Holocaust, which then is now they're spreading it around to everybody.
They blame the whole world for it.
They're eventually going to blame the whole world because maybe this is the thing that they are using that they can say, well, now you see this has happened to us and now the next step is we return to our land and now they've done that and now the next step is that we're supposed to rule the world. Why don't you go on and read from there, Hattie? I'm tired of reading.
Okay. The single description, which will include a larger percentage of Jews than members of any other race, is this: he is in business. It may be only gathering rags and selling them, but he is in business. From the sale of old clothes to the control of international trade and finance, the Jew is supremely gifted for business. More than any other race, he exhibits a decided aversion to industrial employment, which he balances by an equally decided adaptability to trade. The Gentile boy works his way up, taking employment in the productive or technical departments. But the Jewish boy prefers to begin as a messenger, salesman, or clerk, anything, so long as it is connected with the commercial side of the business. An early Prussian census illustrates this characteristic. Of a total population of 269,400, the Jews comprised 6% or 16,164. Of these, 12,000 were traders and 4,164 were workmen. Of the Gentile population, the other 94%, or 153,236 people, there were only 17,000 traders.
I hope everybody gets that. I hope they've, you know, I hope everybody gets that because what it's saying is that there's a way over proportion of traders to workmen amongst the Jews and a great, you know, a whole lot of workmen compared to the traders among the Prussians.
Yeah, Jews were only 6% of the population, but they were about 40% of the traders or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Good.
A modern census would show a large professional and literary class added to the traders, but no diminution of the percentage of traders and not much, if any, increase in the number of wage toilers. In America alone, most of the big business, the trusts and the banks, the natural resources and chief agricultural products, especially tobacco, cotton, and sugar, are in the control of Jewish financiers or their agents. Jewish journalists are a large and powerful group here. Quote, large numbers of department stores are held by Jewish firms, close quote, says the Jewish Encyclopedia. And many, if not most of them, are run under Gentile names. Jews are the largest and most numerous landlords of residence property in the country. Wait a second.
While you're pausing there, I'm going to tell the listeners, because you know what? I didn't tell them that they could call in. And if this is an email. If this is a class we're holding here, well, the students should be able to chime in and ask questions or whatever. So I want to remind people that you can write to Carolyn@CarolynJaeger.com. I've got my email account up here, and I'll check it. I won't forget this time. And if you have something you want to say, well, I'll read it before we finish. We've still got a little over 15 minutes to go. All right, Eddie. Sorry.
They absolutely control the They are supreme in the theatrical world. They absolutely control the circulation of publications throughout the country. Fewer than any race whose presence among us is noticeable, they receive daily an amount of favorable publicity which would be impossible did they not have the facilities for creating and distributing it themselves. Werner Zombart, in his Jew and Modern Capitalism, says, quote, if the conditions in America continue to develop along the same lines as in the past generation, if the immigration statistics and the proportion of births among all the nationalities remain the same, our imagination may picture the United States of 50 or 100 years hence as a land inhabited only by Slavs, Negroes, and Jews, wherein the Jews will naturally occupy the position of economic leadership, close quote. Zombart is a pro-Jewish writer. The question is, if the Jew is in control, how did it happen? This is a free country. The Jew comprises only about 3% of the population. To every Jew, there are 97 Gentiles. To the 3 million Jews in the United States, there are 97 million Gentiles. If the Jew is in control, is it because of his superior ability, or is it because of the inferiority and don't care attitude of the Gentiles? That's a pivotal question right there.
Yes, yes, that's what we're still asking today. I mean, this is maybe this is the Jewish question. I don't know. I think everybody's aware of the importance, and everybody's asking that, or they should be asking that. Why is he in control? Well, there's some answers here. Ford gives some answers.
He does. Okay. It would be very simple to answer that the Jews came to America, took their chances like other people, and proved more successful in the competitive struggle. But that would not include all the facts. And before a more adequate answer can be given, 2 points should be made clear. The first is this. All Jews are not rich controllers of wealth. There are poor Jews aplenty, though most of them, even in their poverty, are their own masters.
Well, you know, I think there's less, there were more poor Jews then than there are now. Most Jews are no longer those New York tenement living Jews. They've made their way into the middle class and so on. But still, the point is still good that they're not all wealthy or rich,
well,
you know, dirty rich.
Probably the average Jewish income is higher than the average of the rest of the population, I would imagine.
Yeah, probably is.
But at that time,
it wasn't so true. You know, I mean, there were a lot of poor Jews then.
There's the observation that Jews are frequently not as poor as they look. You know, all those Holocaust survivors that swallowed their diamonds and washed them off and swallowed them again, you know.
Yeah.
While it may be true that the chief financial controllers of the country are Jews, it is not true that every Jew is one of the financial controllers of the country. The classes must be kept distinct for a reason which will appear when the methods of the rich Jews and the methods of the poor Jews to gain power are differentiated. Secondly, the fact of Jewish solidarity renders it difficult to measure Gentile and Jewish achievements by the same standard. When a great block of wealth in America was made possible by the lavish use of another block of wealth from across the seas, that is to say, when certain Jewish immigrants came to the United States with the financial backing of European Jewry behind them, it would be unfair to explain the rise of that class of immigration by the same rules which account for the rise of, say, the Germans or the Poles, who came here with no resources but their ambition and strength. To be sure, many individual Jews come in that way too, with no dependents but themselves. But it would not be true to say that the massive control of affairs which is exercised by Jewish wealth was won by individual initiative. It was, rather, the extension of financial control across the sea.
Hmm. Well, there you go. There's one reason that they've done so well. They were sent here with plenty of money and people to see and people that would help them to in the financial world, mostly.
Yeah, they wrote their cousin Izzy over in Europe and he wired them some money or whatever. Mm-hmm. Get that studio started. That, indeed, is where any explanation of Jewish control must begin. Here is a race whose entire period of national history saw them peasants on the land, whose ancient genius was spiritual rather than material, bucolic rather than commercial. Yet today, when they have no country, no government, and are persecuted in one way or another everywhere they go, they are declared to be the principal, though unofficial, rulers of the earth. How does so strange a change arise?
Charge.
And why do so many circumstances seem to justify it?
Now, I'm
charge.
Not so...
How does so strange yeah, a charge yeah, arise?
Right. I'm not so sure that these researchers are right about this part. I know this is the, you know, they're going by the normal history that the Jews put out. But I'm not so sure that they were peasants on the land, or that they were bucolic rather than commercial, or all of that. And then the spiritual rather than material. They are always materialists. Who even knows who these Jews, who the Jews were? Who knows who these people were way back then? That the Jews say were themselves. I'm not sure they were Jews. And then we know there's most of the Jews today that are plaguing us are Ashkenazi Jews from Europe, from Middle or Europe,
well,
Eurasian areas. There, I think they're actually Russian.
Even putting aside that whole Khazar thesis,
mm-hmm.
it's pretty well established that the Old Testament is not authentic Jewish history. If you look at a publication like Biblical Archaeology Review, they have articles that make it very clear, for example, that there was never a mass exodus from Egypt.
Yeah. Yeah, I've looked into all that, too. Go ahead, because that's the way I see it.
The Egyptians kept their own history. Okay. And they have no record of anything like that occurring. They had border crossing guards, and they don't have any record of any border crossings like that. There's been archaeology of the site of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and there's no evidence of any Jewish settlement at Jerusalem before the 6th century B.C. That's fairly late. Greek history goes back way farther than that. That's mm-hmm. European history. There are a lot of other things in the Old Testament that are pretty clearly not true. Voltaire actually had a good time making fun of a lot of the Old Testament. They had there's one episode in the Old Testament where there's a river that's about 3 feet deep, 3 feet deep, and they had God part it for them so that they could get across.
That was that great river, the Jordan or something. It was 3 feet deep.
Something. I'm not sure, yeah. But it was one of those. I have that on my blog, by the way, Voltaire.
Well, but anyway, the archaeology, I find it pretty convincing. People say, oh, no, that's not right, David. No, they have to really stretch to say they found a little bit of this or a little bit of that. They really didn't find that there was. So I don't believe it either. I don't believe that.
Yeah, the Old Testament is a pastiche. It's a pastiche of various other people's histories. Probably for the most part. Some of it is Babylonian. Some of it is Egyptian. Some of it is Arabian. Some of it is probably Syrian. Some of it is probably Greek. But they put all that stuff together. Some, you know, they put their own spin on some of it.
Okay. You want to continue reading?
All right. Let's see. Begin at the beginning. During the formative period of their national character, the Jews lived under a law which made plutocracy and pauperism equally impossible among them. Modern reformers who are constructing model social systems on paper would do well to look into the social system under which the early Jews were organized. The law of Moses made a money aristocracy, such as Jewish financiers form today, impossible, because it forbade the taking of interest. It made impossible also the continuous enjoyment of profit wrung out of another's distress. Profiteering and sheer speculation were not favored under the Jewish system. There could be no land hogging. The land was apportioned among the people, and though it might be lost by debt or sold under stress, it was returned every 50 years to its original family ownership, at which time, called the Year of Jubilee, there was practically a new social beginning. The rise of great landlords and a moneyed class was impossible under such a system, although the interim of 50 years gave ample scope for individual initiative to assert itself under fair competitive conditions.
You're going to say something, too. Yeah, I don't think those were the Jews doing that. I don't think those laws were the Jews. That's why I say I don't think these people were Jews. Were the people we know today as Jews, particularly.
I don't think they got that economic morality. I don't think they made that up, but they've copied that probably from somewhere else in the region. But he said, it's interesting, he said, Ford or whoever wrote it, Cameron, whoever, modern reformers who are constructing model social systems on paper would do well to look into this system where development of a plutocracy is impossible. Do you know who actually does discuss that?
Who?
It's a national socialist named Gottfried Feder.
Oh.
He talks about Jubilee and the forgiveness of debts in his manifesto that he wrote in 1919, Manifesto for the Breaking of Enslavement to Interest on Money, which I've been translating.
Well, good. That's good. I'm familiar with Gottfried Feder, but I haven't read all his stuff. So,
I don't think anything by him has been translated. At least, not, I think there's one thing that was translated of his.
That'd be a good reason why I haven't read it. Okay, so let's see. I've lost my place here. But anyway, this, I think, is an important part. That it's just that he's just they're just taking what the Jews say about their history and accepting it. We disagree with that a little bit.
Well, the whole idea of keeping a certain class of the people from getting a lot richer than the rest of the people mm-hmm. is not unique to whoever it was that was actually practicing this thing that ended up in the Old Testament. I think the ancient Germans also used to prevent anybody from getting too rich, and the Spartans used to do that.
That's right.
As long as their society was still healthy. And the reason why they did that is that they wanted their people to be numerous. They wanted each soldier to have enough material prosperity that he could be a soldier and be a strength for the nation. That's the way you make the nation as a whole strong. It's by making sure that the wealth is distributed well enough so that everybody has enough.
Yes. I'm checking to see if there's any question. No, doesn't. Oh, I have to go back here. Doesn't look like it. No. Okay, so we don't have much time left. We have, I wonder if we should read a little bit more. We've got 3 minutes yet. Well, there's a little bit more here about the law of the stranger and so on. Why don't you continue?
Right. If, therefore, the Jews had retained their status as a nation and had remained in Palestine under the law of Moses, they would hardly have achieved the financial distinction which they have won since. Jews never got rich out of one another, even in modern time.
True. Yeah, I think that's
true. When they do, it's a scandal, and you end up with a book like, what was that book, You Gentiles or something? It was one of those books where a Jew got swindled by other Jews and wrote a nasty book about Jews. Even in modern times, they have not become rich out of each other, but out of the nations among whom they dwelt. Jewish law permitted the Jew to do business with a Gentile on a different basis than that on which he did business with a brother Jew. What is called the law of the stranger was defined thus: unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury. Being dispersed upon the nations, and never merging themselves with the nations, and never losing a very distinctive identity, the Jew has had the opportunity to practice the ethics of the stranger
for many centuries. I'm wondering if we should just stop here so we don't have to get pushed off the air so fast. This was our first program with this. I'm marking here where we cut off. And listeners, we will continue where we left off next week. And then we will also be able to do Chapter 2, because Chapter 2 is quite a bit shorter than Chapter 1, which is a long chapter. But we got a lot of it done. So next week we'll be finishing Chapter 1 and doing Chapter 2. And we won't have that introduction to do, so that should not be a problem. And so I hope you will come back to our little course here and continue learning about our hero, Henry Ford's great book. Hadding, it's been great doing this with you.
All right. And, it's been okay.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening.
I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.